goes out to all my aliens. It's love.
Colorful,
colorful DJ Karina on Colorful Radio.
I'm very happy to welcome this week's special guest, Stephanie Erdang. Stephanie, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Karina. I'm so happy to be here.
Thank you so much for coming to do this interview. I know you're traveling and currently promoting your new book, your memoir, Mapping My Way Home, Activism, Nostalgia and the Downfall of Apartheid South Africa. So, beautiful book.
Thank you.
I must say, beautifully written.
Thank you.
At times, you know, I've met you before, but at times I almost forgot that I was reading a memoir and I thought I was reading the most exquisitely written novel because it is beautifully written. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. That's very important to me. Thank you.
And do you write fiction as well? Or?
No, I've worked as a journalist.
Right.
I've written two other books, one on Guinea-Bissau. Mm-hmm. Called Fighting Two Colonialisms. Mm-hmm. That came out in 1979, so it's quite a way back. Mm-hmm. And that covered my visits to Guinea-Bissau when it was fighting against Portuguese colonialism. Mm-hmm. And I trekked through the liberated zones and interviewed women, trying to get a sense of what was happening and what had changed their lives in terms of the revolution. And that book led to an invitation to Mozambique, and at the end of the 1980s, no, beginning of the 1980s, about 1980-81, I started visiting Mozambique to look at what happened to women after independence. Because Mozambique and Guinea-Bissau got independence in 1975. In fact, I was in Guinea-Bissau at the time of the Portuguese coup, which we heard over the radio, a small little radio that was crackling. We could hardly get the reception. And there was no other way of being in contact. And we heard the announcement of the Portuguese coup on April 25th, 1974. And so I was actually there at this very, very pivotal moment. Mm-hmm. And then I began to follow what was happening in Mozambique to women, because I was very interested in really capturing women's lives and how their voices had changed and how their lives were being transformed. And I interviewed women for at all levels and got a sense of what was happening. But unfortunately, in Mozambique, the independence and the growth of a socialist state at that point was a huge threat to apartheid South Africa. So they set about trying to destroy Mozambique and its economy.
Wow.
And pretty much succeeded. So much of my writing in the end was the impact of South Africa's destabilization on Mozambique and what I was seeing in the war, and it was really pretty grim.
Incredible. One thing I was thinking when I came to your book launch last Monday, and also when reading your book, was that this book is right on time. I mean, we spoke briefly about this digital era and how it's sort of opened up and communication, and it's totally changed how people are communicating and interacting, and all the social movements that have come about as a result of that.
Yeah.
It's bringing people closer together, connecting people, and I think that this book is right on time for me because it deals with South African apartheid, which is something that I was always made very aware of when I was a child. My mum lectured anti-discriminatory practice, so this was part of my childhood. I'd always heard this narrative, but until I read your book, and I've seen other films and I've read of Steve Biko and all these leaders, Nelson Mandela, but until I read your book, I hadn't really felt like I had sort of grasped what it would feel like as a woman, as a young person in that environment. And I think your book brilliantly depicts that. But also it approaches things from an intersectional perspective. Mm. Mm. And even everything you were just saying in terms of Mozambique and so forth, it's about how women are affected and how they develop within all the political and social transformation that's taking place, right. and also how different governments and countries are interrelated, and what happens in one country is influencing what happens in another.
Exactly.
Yeah. Was that intentional, or is that just naturally how the story unfolded?
I think it's how the story unfolded. Because, you know, I'd written journalism, basically, mm-hmm. and I had this sense that there was a story to tell about what had happened outside of South Africa mm-hmm. that contributed to the end of apartheid. Mm. Because a lot, obviously, had been written about what happened inside. Mm-hmm. And I felt that I'd been either an observer or a participant in some way of that process. Whether it was the end of Portuguese colonialism, which had a real impact on the struggle in South Africa, whether it was the divestment movement in the US, which had a very strong impact on South Africa's the apartheid economy. Mm-hmm. So I started off thinking I wanted to write a more personal book reflecting those issues mm-hmm. And sort of gathering together my experience over the years mm-hmm. as a journalist mainly. Mm-hmm. But there were other themes that began to sort of emerge and began to sort of tell me, no, I want to be in that book too. Mm. And there were two particular themes. One was the whole question of home. Mm-hmm. For South Africans living abroad during the struggle years, we were incorrigibly nostalgic, I think. But this nostalgia was not so much wanting to return to that past. We obviously loved our country and it's so beautiful and we longed for it. But we, in a lot of ways, were longing for a future. We weren't longing for the past because we didn't want to go back to apartheid. So that sense of being outside South Africa, not going back, yearning for a new South Africa, became a thread in the book that I hadn't actually anticipated when I started writing it. And then also I began to think of the intersection of the feminist movement and the independence movements and the anti-apartheid movement, and those felt very integrated within me. So I couldn't just write about one aspect. I began to realize I was writing about all of them. Mm. And the other thing, just to reflect back on an earlier question, was I was writing as a journalist, and it was very hard for me to write a memoir initially. The first part was easy. I was, remembering my childhood and anecdotes from there. But as I began to write about Guinea-Bissau and Mozambique, I was writing about something else. It wasn't about me, and I got very stiff. And a friend of mine who was a very good editor read it, and she said, I really loved the beginning, and then suddenly your voice disappeared, and you became a journalist again. So I really had to relearn how to write so in this way, and I love it. I mean, it's a type of writing that I'm really gravitating towards, so that's why your comments were particularly helpful. Thank you.
That's really interesting. And how long did it take you to write the memoir?
It was an idea that floated around for over 10 years. And I wrote bits and pieces over time because I didn't really have time full time. But probably the last year or so was maybe 2 years. I spent more focused time mm-hmm. on writing it.
Wow. You start the book with a scene of you with your family watching the release of Nelson Mandela. Mm-hmm. And, what a moment in history. And it was very important to you. By this time, your family were mainly living here in Britain and you
That's right.
had moved
yeah.
to America.
Yes.
But you'd all sort of come together mm-hmm. and you're waiting for the release mm-hmm. and you're watching it live on television. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I mean, you explained it in so much detail and you spoke about the fact that, you know, artists had drawn impressions of what he might have looked like because there were no pictures of him for the whole time that mm-hmm. he was incarcerated. Mm-hmm. And that he looks nothing
right.
like people had expected him
yes.
to look. He was tall, he was elegant, he was upright, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, I just want to speak about that moment. Mm. And I think, you know, obviously it's a very well-known moment, mm-hmm. but I don't think we should take it for granted. What did that moment mean to you?
It was a culmination of everything that I'd wanted in life, in a way. And, you know, represented it. an incredible turning point, not only in South Africa, but in Africa and in the world. And over the years, I've spoken to so many people in so many different countries who were watching at that moment, as if the whole world stopped. Mm-hmm. And everybody waited for that moment that he was going to come out. And it was very, very emotional. I was with my mother and my husband and my daughter, who was something like 3 at the time. And, of course, we waited and waited. The whole world waited and waited. And there was, you know, all this, the journalists and the media people had to fill in. And so there were a lot of comments and chatter, basically. Mm-hmm. and then suddenly he began to emerge, and there was this kind of silence. And it's very hard to describe that kind of emotion when, you know, you've lived under apartheid. I left South Africa not because I was personally persecuted, but because I really could not live under that system. And at that point, in the mid-60s and late 60s, there was really a hiatus in the activism because of Mandela's incarceration and imprisonment, and the movement had really gone underground at that point. And I couldn't see a way of contributing then. Maybe if I'd been a little younger, I would have stayed. As things began to hasten up by the mid-70s, early 70s. So having worked in the anti-apartheid movement in the US and been very, very much in touch with South Africa, I continued to think of myself as South African even as I became more acclimatized to the US. So this was a real, well, it's a triumphant moment, but a very, very emotional one. Mm-hmm. And I remember turning to my husband and just seeing how he was crying. He's Canadian. And he was close to the movement. He wasn't an activist in it. But I realized how much people were affected who weren't even part of that. And, yeah. You know, that was a moment that brought the world together, I think.
Yeah. And, I mean, you wrote the line, Mandela is free, but South Africa is yet to be.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I hear a lot of commentary, particularly amongst my peers, in terms of South Africa today.
Mm-hmm.
And the issues, the social issues, the crime and things like that that you've spoken about in this memoir. But it's almost as if people expected that Nelson Mandela was free and then the end of apartheid came, and then people expected this transformation.
Right.
Where all the
right.
problems disappeared.
Yeah.
And you're very
yeah.
clear very early in this book that that's not been the case.
Yeah.
What were your expectations?
I hoped for a different South Africa now.
Mm-hmm.
I think we all did.
Mm-hmm.
The presidency of Zuma has been not only a disappointment, but it has destroyed part of South Africa. And I think people have lost faith.
Mm-hmm.
But where I see the hope always, and now, of course, there's a new president of the ANC, Cyril Ramaphosa, who I believe is not a corrupt man, and I think will take a different path from Mandela. He also has his own issues.
Mm-hmm.
Not Mandela, sorry, Zuma.
Zuma.
But where I find hope always is, it's almost as if the resistance against apartheid entered the DNA of South Africans. And they don't. They stop. And there are constant responses and demonstrations and demands for better services, for a different South Africa. And I guess I'm, you know, that's where I think hope still lies in the newer generation.
Yeah.
And the hope for change.
Yeah, that's interesting to hear, because some of the criticisms, like quite a famous, I also play music, I'm a DJ,
right.
And quite a famous dance music musician went to South Africa. Obviously, South Africa has, the music scene has exploded there.
Yes.
Particularly the youth and dance music mm-hmm. scene, some phenomenal music producers coming from South Africa. So a visiting DJ from America who lives in Europe went to South Africa, and he was very critical of the black South Africans in terms of what he perceived to be the fact that they were quite very subservient towards white people still, that they still treated white people like they would be served first, or he believed that they had preferential treatment. And he made some quite what was perceived as derogatory remarks about the South Africans.
Yeah.
So it's good to hear what you're saying in terms of the resistance within their DNA, because I think, you know, dynamics are something that's hard to change overnight, and it's also quite complex, isn't it, in terms of...
Well, we have to remember that South Africa's had a democracy for not even 25 years. Mm. Next year, will, in 2019, will be the 25th year.
Yeah.
If you think of America and the civil rights movement and you know, the length of time it took and still is taking to deal with the, you know, incredible inequalities...
Mm-hmm.
in America. And I mean, this has become a big issue now with in America. And it's a lot of young people are, and not only young people, I mean, there's a real awakening. And of course, with President Trump, there's a need for that awakening.
Yeah.
But South Africa's had 25 years, and I think we cannot underestimate the kind of impact that apartheid had. Mm. on people living there, and the total destruction of their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's going to take time. But on the other hand, you know, I think what the DJ you're talking about saw a slice of it. It's not the real South Africa to me.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love the way that you described returning home to South Africa with your husband and your daughter. And you were just speaking of the majesty of nature and this mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And you had so many thoughts of this mountain and memories of how beautiful it was. And you're so proud to take your husband, who you said is Canadian, and your daughter to finally see home.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But then you sort of go into some memories of what it was like.
Yeah.
And then the same mountain, you... refer to it from a different perspective, from people who lived in different neighbourhoods, from black South Africans.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a bit more about that sort of feeling of coming home, the beauty of your country, and then the pain as well.
Yeah. You know, I was very excited to return to South Africa. It was 1991. I've sort of got a mind block at the moment. 1991. So it was a year after Mandela was released.
Right.
So there was now a lot of hope. So that, you know, apartheid wasn't yet over, but the writing was on the wall. Mm. And so I was very excited about going back to Cape Town and reconnecting. And I had these memories of the mountain and the sea and the beauty. I mean, so, you know, I unashamedly will say that Cape Town is the most beautiful city in the world. But so I was driving from the airport, and the mountain is, you can see it right very clearly from the airport. So as you drive from the airport, you head to the mountain, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. But you also pass the squatter settlements, the African townships that are right on the edge of the road. And the contrast is stunning. You know, and I'd forgotten in a way. I was so focused on wanting to see that mountain again that I'd forgotten what South Africa was really like. I hadn't forgotten, I shouldn't say that, but I'd put it in the recesses of my mind.
Hmm.
And so I also realized that other people were looking at that mountain in a very, very different way because the people that lived around those mountains were whites and the Africans and blacks lived in terrible conditions, you know, on the so-called Cape Flats.
Mm-hmm.
So I had this sort of contrast. Wait a minute, there's something else going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the comment I made in the book was that I realized I couldn't return. I could return to South Africa, but I couldn't return to the beauty without recognizing the pain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That both are very much part of South Africa.
Yeah. And I guess... You had to consider both as you were writing a memoir,
mm-hmm.
but you know, when we experience life, we have many sort of parallel experiences happening at the time. So, and I think that was like a sort of running theme in the book: the fact that the way that you described South Africa and the beauty of South Africa and home. Mm-hmm. And you even spoke about your dad's office. Mm-hmm. When you were a child, he was a lawyer in the black area.
Yeah.
And
so-called coloured area.
In the colour, okay.
Yeah.
Right.
And, I mean, my father was... I remember the refrain through my childhood was that my father saying I could not practice law in the centre of Cape Town and tend to the wills and the divorces of whites. Mm-hmm. He was very political as a young man. Mm-hmm. And so he set up his office in a black area. Mm-hmm. And he was very committed to that. And I think as a young person becoming more aware... So basically I grew up in an anti-apartheid family, mm-hmm. which is a very different experience for many of my friends or my schoolmates. But as I got older, you know, and as a teenager and young 20s, I began to sort of think, you know, he was political, but then he wasn't an activist in his older years. And, you know, as we tend to, we can be fairly disdainful about our parents at that age. And in writing the book, what happened was that he died in 1977. I realized that he had made a decision when he was young, and he had stayed with that. And he wasn't, we never, I mean, obviously we were white, we lived extremely well. But we never had the kind of wealth that lawyers who worked in the white areas had. And, you know, I began to respect him in a totally different way. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of sad because I think this happens often as you get older and you begin to reflect on the relationship with your parents. And, of course, it's too late, you can't tell them. Mm-hmm. But there was a moment of reconciliation just before he died that was very important to me.
That's interesting. So his resistance wasn't necessarily protesting in the streets, but in terms of the way he structured his life.
Right, he walked his own walk.
Africa. Exactly. Amazing. And you sort of speak about your father in detail and say he was obviously... an activist in his own rights, you've just described, but also he was like authoritarian.
Very.
He was old school. You said you could set your watch by him walking towards the front door at 6:30,
right.
And he wouldn't speak until he was at the head of the table and his dinner was there on time,
right.
And then he would speak and that's when the conversations would start. How did that impact you or shape your views in terms of women and, you know, feminism and activism? Mm-hmm. Having a father who was, an activist in his own right, but also quite old school
right,
in that sense.
Yeah. I was very intimidated by him as a child. Mm. And I think that, I mean, it was interesting. So it took me a while to find my own voice in the sense that I could think separately from him. I think until my teenage years, I would sort of listen to him and sort of mimic his, you know, what he was saying, because that was the truth. You know, he was the strong authoritarian. And he basically told me, no, don't think for yourself. You know, I know everything. You know, think like me. And then, you know, there was a sense of rebellion. But I was very insecure. I was extremely insecure as a teenager in my 20s. And when I got to the United States, it was end of 1967, and 1968 was a ground shed year. I mean, it was just Martin Luther King was killed, Robert Kennedy was killed, the Black Panthers were very active, the Vietnam War was being protested, and the women's movement was growing, and the anti-apartheid movement was growing. It was extraordinary. Coming from a totalitarian state and from a family in which I felt there was a sort of reflection of that in terms of my father's authoritarianism, to see this freedom, what I thought initially was just, oh my God, I've come to a free country. Didn't take me long to realize that there were freedom wasn't equal.
Yeah.
But the women's movement was a very important catalyst to me because I began to realize that other women were exactly like I was, you know, that it wasn't just me that didn't have this self-esteem that I felt everybody around me had. Mm. And the talking and the discussions and about change at that point were very important to me.
You describe in detail what the like details of the resistance and the extreme bravery. First of all, let me just say the fact that I found the fact that you went to America by yourself and your family came to England quite a brave act. So I must say that I thought, oh wow, that's quite extraordinary. Was that an easy decision for you to make?
It was actually a decision made for me by happenstance. Mm-hmm. I was engaged. Well, I was going to be married. I think before formally engaged, and I was to a South African at that point. And we were going to leave. And my decision to leave was clinched when I was working for an organization called Defence and Aid, which International Defence and Aid was a big organization in London. Mm-hmm. And it funded Defence and Aid in South Africa, which provided covered the fees for lawyers so that people charged under the political acts could get proper defence. And it also provided funds for families mm-hmm. of the people who were imprisoned or waiting trial. So it was a very important organisation, and then it was banned. And that's when I sort of felt, you know, I didn't know where else to turn. So I thought, well, we would leave. And I was very ambivalent about it. I was extremely ambivalent. But, you know, I was in love, and my husband was wanting to leave, and he was going to study physics, and he had a whole world that he wanted to go to. And we were going to go to London. And my parents were in London. My sister was in London. I had many relatives in London. There was a big anti-apartheid movement in London. It just seemed the right place to go. Mm-hmm. And we were crossing the street, and he was knocked over by a car. And he landed up in hospital for about 6 weeks, I think, because his leg was very badly damaged, and he finally got out, and he had to sort of learn to walk again. And this meant that he lost almost half of his honours year, and had he done well in that for that honours degree, he would have got a scholarship to come to a university in London or in England, which was just assumed by his professors. Well, he didn't do that well because of the accident, so he couldn't get into a university in England that would cover, or UK that would cover all his fees. He couldn't get a scholarship, basically. So we turned to America, and at that point, also because he was a physicist, he was very excited by the idea of going to America. And I followed. Mm-hmm. And and we had initially thought, well, he'd finish his PhD and then we'd go back to England. But I fell in love with America, and I felt energized by America in a way that I hadn't anticipated. And the women's movement there was very strong, and it was a very mixed movement. I was sort of part of what we thought of as the socialist women's movement, which was intent on changing the system, not in just changing roles. And it was a very strong, and it was, and very energized, you know, as I said, very, very energized. So it wasn't so much that I was brave, really. It just sort of happened that right. way. And I'm, you know, and I'm just, looking back at my life, I feel very lucky, actually, fortunate that it turned out that way, because I became a writer. I did things that I'm not sure would have happened here. I don't know what would have happened if I'd, you know, been in Britain all this time. But it was South Africans who came to the UK had immediately a whole community to be part of. That wasn't the case in America. Which also meant that we sort of entered the American scene in a way, you know, more determinedly.
You sort of carved your own niche. It sounds like the perfect fit in terms of activism, particularly in that era. And it was interesting in the book that you spoke of demonstrations. You spoke of one horrific demonstration where the crowd were trying to run away and the police had shot people in the back. And it was a very short account, but it was poignant, especially, as I said, for someone who I've not had this sort of account of South Africa before. But you also spoke about an activist, Philip Kogosana?
Have I pronounced? Kosana.
Kosana.
Yes, yeah.
Philip Kosana, who was a former student at the University of Cape Town, but he couldn't get a scholarship for his living expenses, so he lived in the single-sex barracks, which were for male workers, and that exposed him to what other people, what the workers were experiencing. You said that he was working for the Pan-Africanist Congress,
mm-hmm.
Who and they had broken away from the ANC. And you said that that the criticism of the ANC was that it was too accommodating to whites. And I was just wondering, do you think, did you ever think at that time that the ANC was too accommodating to whites? And perhaps retrospectively now, what are your thoughts on
that? I think it's more retrospective than what I thought at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly not. I mean, I think the richness of the ANC was that it basically said whoever is willing to fight against apartheid and to be committed to that fight is welcome, whether you're white or coloured or Indian or African, using the categories, the South African apartheid categories. And so, you know, some of the top leaders of the ANC have been white.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the majority is African and the majority of the population in South Africa is African.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that's an accommodation. I think it's a reality that, that is very, very important.
Mm-hmm.
That we, you know, we come from different backgrounds, but we have a goal that's the same.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, a very sort of prevalent discussion at the moment is sort of people talking about white privilege and, you know, as we've mentioned earlier, intersectional feminism, for example. And I think there's a general narrative at the moment that all white people have a duty to acknowledge their privilege.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, you know, when we think of anti-discriminatory practice, everybody needs to reflect.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess if you sort of aren't aware of your own privilege or how your experiences uniquely shape your point of view, and that might differ for other people, then obviously, you know, whoever you are, there's going to be, there's going to be criticism. But I think, do you think that you were in a unique perspective because you came from an anti-apartheid family? You mentioned that you were quite different from your peers at school in that respect, and also some of your friends, that you came from that anti-apartheid family. And do you think that white South Africans who had been brought up in a different way could be, could champion the anti-apartheid movement in the same way?
I mean, I think white privilege is a very, very real aspect of life, of reality, wherever you are. And it was a message that I got from my father and my parents, you know, it was that you're very privileged and never forget that. Just repeat that question.
So I was thinking,
lost the track.
In terms of sort of your anti-apartheid stance, I was thinking of the criticism of the ANC from some saying it was too accommodating to whites.
Yeah.
Do you think that other white people were in such were in the position to be strongly anti-apartheid based on their sort of white privilege?
It was, apartheid was so obvious. You could, you know, and obviously I grew up in a family that saw it, so I saw it as a child. Well, didn't see it that much as a young child, but began to see it. Perhaps by the age of 8 or 9 or 10, I began to be more aware. And what has struck me when I went back to South Africa in 1991 and then at other points later, meeting whites who would say, oh, I'm so pleased apartheid is over. I so hated apartheid. And I'm thinking, you did? You know, because there was not a groundswell amongst whites in terms of, there was no groundswell of whites against the apartheid system. Mm-hmm. And yet when it was over, they were so relieved because they felt that in retrospect it was an evil system and that now they were freed from it and they didn't have to feel guilty. So we always sort of laugh a bit at the number of whites that suddenly are so happy about the end of apartheid, but during the time did nothing. Mm-hmm. And many will just say, well, I didn't know. You know, same in Germany, we didn't know. You know, it was not hard to find out. Mm. And so there was just this extraordinary complacency. Mm. And in fact, in 1984, I managed to get a visa to go back when I was working as a journalist. And I went back for a few weeks, and the thing that struck me more than anything was this unbelievably believable complacency amongst the whites. It sort of horrified me, you know, rubbed up against my skin in a way. Mm. Because I could see how, if you're complacent like that and you're just accepting the status quo, mm-hmm. how hard it is to bring about change when, you know, the economy is controlled and every aspect of somebody's life is controlled. So I think it was every white South African had a responsibility to see this mm-hmm. and to say no, but they didn't. Mm-hmm. You know, very few did. Yeah. But on the other hand, they presented, I think it's less than 15% of the population. Mm. So we knew in a way that apartheid had to end. I mean, just in terms of the sheer numbers. Mm-hmm. But it really, the control that the apartheid and the white government had over the system was very, very difficult to break. Because people often say, why did it take so long? And it wasn't so long when you think of what had to be overcome.
Yeah, it was extreme. And, you know, you speak in detail about the passes and mm-hmm. how black South Africans had to carry these passes mm-hmm. that basically dictated sort of or laid out every detail of their lives. Mm-hmm. It said where they had to be at any particular time and, you know, where they were allowed to go and who, you know, and I just thought, wow, that is control.
Right.
It was quite shocking. But then we can put this into sort of, you know, looking at the contemporary landscape, you know, I see many people that I think in this day and age are quite complacent. Mm-hmm. But then I guess people are living their lives. Yeah. And we do sort of acclimatize, or a lot of people acclimatize mm-hmm. to the environments that they're living in. And I guess that also sort of makes, sort of like puts your father, the way you wrote about him in the book, it sort of positions him as quite radical in terms of the way he chose to live his day-to-day life, his mm-hmm. normal everyday life mm-hmm. was in a way that was for the anti-apartheid movement mm-hmm. as opposed to mm-hmm. Just having another job yeah, and having right. a point of view, yeah. you know.
No, so, exactly.
So that was quite interesting. Another discussion that is brought up quite a lot, and I've not been to South Africa yet, but I do hear people speaking about it a lot, and people speak a lot about the carjacking and the robberies. And in terms of, and the violence, because mm-hmm. and you refer to it in the book, that, you know, on the way back, when you were taking your husband and your daughter to Cape Town, you were feeling quite proud because, you know, in your memory, Cape Town was a relatively safe place, but things had changed and it had become more violent, and you'd heard that someone you knew had been shot dead, and carjackings and robberies were taking place, and after people were robbed, the perpetrator would still shoot them. So it was like this violence and, mm-hmm. you know, this culture of violence. Mm-hmm. Where do you think that's come from, and do you see that subsiding anytime soon?
I see it's, I think it's clear where it's come from. Mm. The subsiding is going to mean a much more equal South Africa than is now. Mm-hmm. The anger against apartheid and the ways that people lived, were forced to live. Mm. Nobody should have to go through that. Mm-hmm. And so when there's a sense of freedom, but it's not yet impacting on your own lives, And you've grown up in a system where maybe you haven't been able to get a decent education, where your access to goods is very limited. Mm-hmm. It's the only way you can get the goods.
Yeah.
Which is not to just, not to sort of justify it, but it's understandable within that. It's totally understandable within that system.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the, we had hoped, I guess, that by 25 years on, there would be more sense of equality and less poverty in South Africa, and unfortunately that has not happened.
Mm-hmm.
Violence is going to continue. Violence continues in any country where there's that kind of inequality.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think your perspective is very empathetic. Rightly so. I mean, you say that, it's obvious where the violence has come from. But quite often when I hear people speak of the violence, there doesn't seem to be that understanding or that level of empathy in terms of the perpetrators, in terms of where that actually does come from.
Yeah.
But I'm hoping that doesn't sort of impede any kind of progress in that respect.
I hope so.
Yeah.
And again, there is this sort of sense that change has to come and will come, and it's a process.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. At the end of your reading on Monday, mm-hmm. you read a passage, I think it was at the end of the book, mm-hmm. just speaking about coming home and you acknowledging the fact that, that you had the privilege to sort of go and come mm-hmm. back and so mm-hmm. forth. Would you like to read perhaps a paragraph
sure.
on that?
Sure.
Yeah, that'd be lovely. Good.
This is towards the end of the book. It's a chapter called Finding Home.
Mm-hmm.
I am sitting in the back seat of a taxi on the way to Johannesburg's O.R. Tambo Airport. The 3 months that had stretched ahead so invitingly when I arrived have flown by. Next to me is John, who joined me for the last 2 weeks of my stay. I find myself edging away, turning my shoulders so that my back is towards him, my green-carded Canadian partner, who represents a future we are heading towards, one I do not want to face. Words enter my mind, unbidden, pricking like barbs. I love this country. I love this country. I have lived in the United States, mostly in and around New York, for almost twice the years I spent growing up in South Africa, and yet I'm never moved to say these words about my adopted country. And I could never respond to the taste of a peach the way I did in my cousin Jill's house. In a 2-inch-thick, weathered wooden bowl, 4 peaches rub up against other fruit, bananas, plums, avocados, mangoes, pineapples. I casually select a small, perfectly ripe, imperfectly rounded, soft, furry-skinned, bright orange one. The New Jersey peaches I buy at the farmer's market each summer have a window of a day or two before underripe and fraught, before they lose their flavor to their bruises. If you eat them at precisely the right moment, they are pretty delicious. Or so I thought, until I bite into my first Cape peach in many years. What I taste is the essence of peach, which enters my mouth, expands there, and flows over my mind, releasing dormant memories. With this one sensual taste, I am home. I'm also reminded of why I left. Who picked the peaches of my childhood? Who packed the peaches so they arrived in the stores unbruised? Who could afford to buy them and place them in bowls on tables in scrubbed and shiny kitchens in such abundance that a child walking by could grab one and eat it as she went about her life of privilege and ease? It was thoughts such as these that stayed with me throughout my trip, even as Cape Town insinuated itself into me, prodding at buried memories and forgotten senses, smell, taste, sight, sound, that reconnected synapses I had thought were severed forever. There's something about growing up in this tortured, brutal, beautiful country that grabs me and never lets go. I will once more forget the taste of a peach, but I cannot escape the hold. I know that while I don't hanker after the physicality of America, I do hanker after the community I've made there. I can no longer claim South Africa as home, even as I continue to grapple after all this time with where that home is, and even where at the stage of my life it is necessary, and even whether at this stage of my life it is necessary to identify it. It takes the death of Nelson Mandela 2 years later to fully clinch what home means to me. With Madiba's death and mourning his passing as a hybrid South African-American, I know I have come much closer to resolving the question. For me, home oscillates between two continents. I'm at home in both the United States and South Africa. When I'm in one, I miss the other. I need both in order to reconcile who I am, to feel comfortable in my skin. At the same time, I cannot pry loose those hooks that were embedded in me the day I was born, nor do I wish to. Nonetheless, I've lived in the United States since the end of 1967. I've been here far longer than the 23-plus years I lived in South Africa. Hooks have surfaced here, too. I've come to love the notion that I have not one home. The world is my home. Home, Africa, the world. And yet, as real as these thoughts and emotions are to me, the words of my father surface out of my childhood.